This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
By the Book on BFM 89.9.
Welcome to By the Book. I'm Sharmila Ganesan together with Lee Tri Lin. And today joining us is a special guest who you will recognize from shows such as I Love KL and Bila Larut Malam, Hanif Baharuddin.
Hi. Thank you for having me here.
So Hanif is here, of course, because this is our second episode of our book club, right?
That's right.
Where we all collectively read a book and then discuss it, as is the way with book clubs. In the first one, we heard from Ti Xiao Yik, who is the producer and presenter of Health and Living. And she chose a very health-based book, When Breath Becomes Air. So, Hanif, is your book of choice related to the shows you do on the station? Talk to us about it. What is it?
Okay, so it's The Pig That Wants to Be Eaten and 99 Other Thought Experiments by Gillian Bagini. And I don't think that it's really that relatable to what I do here, I guess. It's just that it's, I find it quite interesting, and hence the reason why when you guys approached me and asked me to be on this show, I thought of like a book that might be, I guess, that made an impact on me. And I feel like this book, for some reason, made quite an impact on me. So hence, I decided to choose this, despite it not being literary in nature.
And in your own words, despite it not really being a book.
Correct. Hanif's exact words were, I don't know if you would consider this a book. And it is a bunch of pages with words on them bound. So yes, if nothing else, it's a book.
So what made you suggest this book to us, Hanif?
I don't really read that much, but I know among the things that I've read some fictions, but I don't feel like I reflect a lot on them. Whereas for some reason, this book, I can sort of like relate to it, because I think I discovered this book at a point in my life when I was like trying to like find answers to things, and also in the mode where I was a bit more reflective. And I find that this book has that impact on me, and hence the reason why I sort of like think, okay, maybe I should, you know, recommend this book instead.
Is there a real you? This might seem to you like a very odd question, because, you know, you might ask, how do we find the real you? How do you know what the real you is, and so forth? But the idea that there must be a real you, surely that's obvious. If there's anything real in the world, it's you. Well, I'm not quite sure. At least we have to understand a bit better what that means.
You know, you said that it kind of hit you at a point where you were looking for answers a little bit. But all this book does is pose questions.
I was just going to say, I'm left with more questions than when I began.
Because as the title suggests, it's, you know, 100... It's all over, in total. It is 100 thought experiments, right? And it is, I suppose, in many ways, a book of pop philosophy. It extracts different sorts of thought experiments from various sources, from philosophy, but from film, from works of fiction.
Yeah.
And then he kind of elucidates what those experiments, he fleshes it out for you, but he almost provides no answers. I think at no point does he say, therefore think like this.
Good question. I think for me, it's precisely the fact that because at that point in time, I was interested in thought experiments, right? Or rather, thinking not in a linear way. Because I think, let's face it, we all have our own positions and biases, right, when it comes to things. But back then, when I was a bit younger, I was trying to find myself. I was trying to look at things from two different perspectives, right? Because at least, well, things can be gray, but usually it's black and white sometimes. So I tried to, and because at that time I was also in debate, and so one of the things about debates is that sometimes you have to learn to think from the other side. You know, despite having your own position on certain things, you have to start thinking about things from the other perspective. So I think my friend introduced me to this book, and he said that, okay, dude, you should check this out because this will help you think about things from a different perspective. Yeah, so when I read it, I was like, okay, this makes sense. Yeah, because yes, it poses a lot of questions, but for me at that point in time, I was trying to look for how to flesh out the way I think and different perspectives that I can sort of like see things, and hence the reason why it's good for me at that time because I was like just trying to find myself. At the same time, you're trying to set into all these perspectives and biases that you have. So when I read this book, it sort of like put me in a different perspective. Like at least I was able to navigate and to like see things from a different lens, I guess.
Mm. Did it do the same for you, Sharmila? I mean, did you find yourself, did you find some of your perspectives being challenged?
I think Not so much for me, but I did find it interesting. So one of the things that I did enjoy about the way Julian poses his thought experiments is that he links them to fiction, he links them to film. And because I'm a very heavy consumer of both books and movies, I felt like a lot of these conflicts that he talks about, I had already encountered them in one way or another in a lot of other forms. But to have them sort of distilled and put together in this way was quite interesting for me.
So my personal challenge with this book was to get away from emotion. Because what I found a lot of the... So my implicit biases, I suppose, here were not necessarily to do with issues even of, for example, religion, which comes up a lot mm-hmm. in the course of the book. I have my own views. It's not something that I found very very oppositional in that sense to views that I already hold. But where I found myself was in the moral questions, the ones where it's like, look, so if somebody were to give a knighthood to an odious rich person, and because you give that knighthood, they then donate tens of millions of pounds to Africa, and therefore you know for a fact that it's going to go to good as opposed to them spending it on themselves, what is the moral good there? Mm-hmm. And so those were the questions that I found myself kind of being challenged in terms of what my immediate answer would be.
Yes.
And then why is that the case, right? And as somebody who tends to go on gut, as someone who tends to go with, you know what, this feels right, so I think that's correct, having that, even that idea of the gut feel being called into question, that was what was interesting to me.
And you're right with that, stripping away the emotions of it, which is what fiction doesn't do.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Fiction usually puts in a lot of emotional loading onto these questions. So we tend to be driven by character, circumstance, whereas he actually presents these facts very neutrally, even when it comes to something like someone murder someone, this is why they did it. But there's no emotion, right?
Yeah.
So you're able to think of those factors in a very neutral way. And that was interesting for me.
That's the thing, because I remember the first time when I read it, I remember appreciating that neutrality that he was trying to present in his arguments. It's just that funny that when I read it again, I think, and this is where I feel like as you grow older, maybe it's just me growing older, right? But when I read it like the second time, you know, like a couple of weeks ago, I felt like, I felt slightly challenged and I felt slightly uncomfortable. I think because maybe because I have sort of like sent into my, I've sort of like find my rhythm and find my quote unquote identity now, and I've sort of like subscribed to whatever I believe in, that when I read this, when I read this again, I feel like a bit challenged. Yeah.
Was there anything specifically that you found challenging? I mean, any one of the 100 that you read and thought, oof, I don't know, or I need to kind of take this away and mull it over in particular?
In general, I think maybe those with religion, I guess. The one was a bit I wouldn't just do it provocative, but it was a bit more challenging, I guess, to a certain extent. But even then, I remember the first time when I read that those moments, I did feel slightly challenged by it, but that's not the point of it. I think the point of reading this book is to be open-minded and to tackle, or rather to listen to whatever arguments that are being made. And to be fair to Julian, he did present both sides of the argument fairly, mm-hmm. quite neutrally. Yeah, it's just that this time around, the religion aspect of things was quite challenging for me, and also the moral stuff as well. Yeah, and I don't know, maybe again, I was a bit younger and much more eager back then. So I remember enjoying it so much more than when I read it a couple of weeks ago. I don't know. Maybe I'm just getting older.
Or maybe that's just how we should all be appreciating books. I think what you're describing is an experience that a lot of people have had of either, you know, revisiting something that you didn't like all that much and then you love later on, uh-huh. or revisiting something that you absolutely loved and either finding something entirely different in it or not liking it as much. Well, I mean, there are a lot of different reactions to books, and that's part of the beauty of reading, I think.
Yeah, and sometimes partly why I don't like revisiting books that I felt changed me in some way, because often when I revisit them at a different point in life, I'm usually underwhelmed, so I tend not to.
Did this book spawn off an interest in philosophy for you? I mean, did it then, did it cause you to go and look up, I don't know, Descartes? Or did it make you go, oh, I need to read about the cave? Did it spawn that off? You know, whether it's into other books or just simply down Google rabbit holes. Did you end up doing that?
Yes. I think by virtue of maybe, of course, I was involved in night school as well. And night school is a show on philosophy. So I think I think it came at a perfect timing. So after I read this book, I was involved in night school. So eventually I tend to like listen to a lot of night school, and also maybe not books, but I tend to Google a lot, or rather discuss philosophical ideas with friends. I think that's how I generally, what do you call this, consume or spark this interest or bounce it off with like friends. And maybe not philosophers per se, but more of like just little thought experiments that I conduct with my friends, yeah. Mm. On issues that may not be morally ambiguous, but a bit more like situational based, yeah.
So we do need to take a break. But when we come back, we will continue our book club discussion with Hanif Baharuddin on The Pig That Wants to Be Eaten by Julian Bajini. You're listening to Buy the Book on BFM 89.9.
Brainy, fancy material. BFM 89.9.
Welcome back. You're listening to Buy the Book. I'm Sharmila Ganesan, and together with me is, as usual, Lee Trillin.
Hello.
And Hanif Baharuddin, who is joining us for our monthly book club. We're talking about Julian Bajini's The Pig That Wants to Be Eaten, which is a book of 100 thought experiments that have led to a lot of questions and some answers for us.
Very few answers. I mean, the very structure of the book, I mean, we spoke about it a little earlier, but just to reiterate, it plucks out thought experiments from a variety of sources, including sort of more traditional philosophical sources, as well as films, fiction, and distills it into a very neutral toned, this is what it is, what do you think? And then lays out the arguments, right? Yeah. It doesn't really offer easy answers. Instead, it's more like niggling little provocative things lobbied into your brain going, what do you think? What do you think?
Yeah. So I'm curious as to how did you guys read this book? Because for me, it wasn't cover to cover. It's not like I sat down, started in the beginning and went to the end. I tried doing that and it kind of got a little bit much for me. So then I ended up actually opening it at random pages because it's an experiment a page. So I actually started reading it that way. And then I started thinking, is that how everyone else reads this book?
I read it cover to cover.
Okay. Yeah. And like all at once in sort of like one go?
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, maybe not in one sitting.
Yeah, but like as in you consistently stuck with it from beginning to end.
Yes.
Did you find that with the ones that were starting to get a little bit similar or that explored similar themes, could you tease out the differences? Because that's what I ended up struggling with.
I actually struggled with the same thing as well because there were some repetitions.
And they just started seeming like versions of the same problem or the same issue, right?
Yeah, but tackled slightly differently, but it's still almost similar. So I had the same problem as well.
Did you read it cover to cover twice? Because you've read it twice now. And did you read it the same way each time?
Yes.
Ah, okay. So I, true to form, Sharmila, we did the same thing. I attempted to read it from start to finish and I got to about, I think, 30-odd experiments. And I just started thinking, what is intelligence? Are we all computers? What is God? You know, and so it became a bit heavy, despite the fact that they are very light little snacks of chapters, actually. I just started feeling heavy and weighed down by it. And then I had to take a break. And then I found that actually, flipping from page to page, just opening it at random and looking through it, that was a much more enjoyable way to read this book for me.
I'm actually genuinely impressed, Hanif, that you could do
me
it.
Too.
Yeah, because I started feeling just pulled in too many directions. It's like too many questions and not getting the answers. It really started to bother me after a while. and then I read people online calling this book a great party book, where they said, oh, you just pull it out at parties and you like read out one of the experiments and then you discuss it. And I was like, I've obviously been going to the wrong parties.
Or, you know, depending on what you want out of a party, maybe the right one. But I would agree with that, with it being a good party book or a good friendly discussion book. Have you used it in that vein?
Not in a party, but I think with a bunch of friends who are, you know, like-minded, I guess.
Yeah, it's because a party one.
because I think thought experiments, I think it depends on the kind of friends you have, or even like your character, right? Whether you're like curious about these things. Because I remember my friend telling me that back then when they were much younger, they used to have these kind of conversations with their friends, with his friends rather. And it was back then, I think because you were younger, right? So sometimes things can be a bit more provocative in nature. So you sometimes you're just trying to provoke another friend of yours who might be a bit more, I guess, less open-minded in his or her position, right? So you end up becoming provocative. And when he told me that story, I sort of like remember that, oh yeah, sometimes I do have that kind of conversations with my friend. But what I like better about the book is that it's definitely less provocative, because sometimes the thing about thought experiments that sometimes it can easily be provocative, right? Because you call it thought experiment, but you can still take a position and try right. to just provoke your friend or you
and
know whoever
end friendships
you're
and relationships.
I suppose
that's a really important point to bring up about the book, which is that I do firmly believe that the purpose of each thought experiment is to provoke thought. It's not necessarily to provoke. Unnecessary. Is any discussion unnecessary? Yes, I think you can say that. I don't think it's there just to provoke unnecessary discussions or unnecessary points of view being taken just for the sake of it. Nothing in this book is just for the sake of it, even though the term thought experiment would denote that, right? Instead, it really is, I think, ways of introducing very elemental parts of philosophy or very elemental questions, such as, I know I've brought it up already, but the cave recurs throughout the book, right? The idea that, what are you viewing, really? Mm-hmm. You know, are you even seeing the real world? Who, and if you're not, then who are you in that context? And that is just an age-old question. I mean, it's Plato. It's old.
Yes.
2,400 years ago, one of history's most famous thinkers said life is like being chained up in a cave, forced to watch shadows flitting across a stone wall. Pretty cheery, right? That's actually what Plato suggested in his Allegory of the Cave, found in Book 7 of The Republic, in which the Greek philosopher envisioned the ideal society by examining concepts like justice, truth, and beauty.
So the fact that it's introduced in this way, I think, makes it more digestible. Yeah, I've used the word snack before, and I think that that's what this book is.
And I think it's very clever, and I know I mentioned this earlier, but I found the fact that he managed to link these ideas like Plato or Descartes to things like Blade Runner or Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy or Ray Bradbury. You know, I liked that because not everyone would be completely on board with wanting to discuss a central question in Plato's philosophy. But I think a lot of people will be like, hey, you know, Blade Runner and that whole idea with, you know, what is intelligence,
replicants.
What is consciousness? What do you think?
She's a replicant, isn't she?
I'm impressed. How many questions does it usually take to spot one?
I don't get it, Tyrell.
How many questions?
20, 30 cross-referenced.
It took more than 100 for Rachel, didn't it?
She doesn't know.
She's beginning to suspect, I think.
Suspect? How can it not know what it is?
I feel like he hits that point between remaining true to the philosophical underpinnings while not being snobby about it.
Yes, yeah. Yes. There's no snobbery in this book, which was part of what made it enjoyable. Hanif, we have to ask, there are 100 thought experiments here. Did you have a favorite?
Okay, I won't say favorite because I think I like a lot of them, but maybe one that is quite memorable for me. Yeah. So it's number 60. It's do as I say, not
He's
as I
do. He's
got
the number.
Yes, I know.
Just for easy reference for you guys, right? So it's do as I say, not as I do. So this is basically about, I think, an environmentalist who was doing a presentation on the impact of flying on global warming. And she basically said that she would like go all across the world to what do you call this, to present, to give talks about this. But at the same time, and ironically, the talk was about, you know, the impact of flying on global warming, right? So she sort of like justified her, what she knows that she's technically being like a hypocrite, right, by doing that, but she sort of like justified it by saying that, well, I'm doing this, my impact on this is less compared to the potential impact that I could do by giving talks and getting a lot more other people not to fly.
Mm.
Yeah, which I find quite intriguing because I think we've been in this situation a lot of times, right, where we have people who, you know, tend to live by that adage of like, do as I say, not as I do, right?
Right.
Yeah. So I and the way Julian broke the argument down was quite interesting, saying that, emphasizing to a certain extent that, you know, the act of her, it's not so much that she's being a hypocrite, but it's just that the fact that she's not living by her words, that was problematic, I think.
Mm. Yeah. This is Jane Goodall, isn't it?
It sounds like it might be.
I mean, the name of the person in the example, I think, is Irene Janice. And she's henceforth referred to as Janice in the rest of the example. Those are the ones that I find particularly interesting when you can imagine yourself in that situation. And that was one of the examples I meant as well when I said you have to divorce emotion and your immediate gut reaction to it. Because one of the points that the writer made was that one reason why you might fundamentally feel that this person is behaving poorly is because she's being hypocritical. She's doing a hypocritical thing, and yet her logic is almost unassailable. So it is. That's one of those where you have to take a step back from just saying, no, she's wrong. She's wrong.
Yeah, I must say, I'm going to interject here that I would pay good money to hear Hanif Baharuddin re-explain the 100 thought experiments, because that tone that you took when you were explaining it was just so fun. Sometimes more fun than reading it in the book.
Occasionally, yes. Yeah. That is an occasional flaw with the book. My favorite was, favorite, again, you're right, Hanif, it's a strong word. It's more like one that echoed for me throughout the rest of the book was number 28, since we're doing numbers, the nightmare scenario in which there is, to put it simply, there is a woman who had an awful nightmare and then she woke from it and she felt an immediate sense of relief, and then the nightmare continued.
Right.
And then it ends again and she lies there in bed thinking, well, is it over or is it not? And it has that central question that, again, recurs about what is reality? How do you, in fact, know that, well, fundamentally, you're not in the matrix? How do you know that you are awake? How does anybody measure consciousness, mm-hmm. or what world we're in or what has happened? And that, I've lived through this. I think a lot of us have, of, you know, waking up from a very realistic dream and then waking up again from the second realistic dream and going, okay, hold on, what?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I thought that the way the intellectualization of that situation was laid out was actually quite helpful to me in understanding what goes on.
Yeah, and a very popular theme in so much of literature and film that I think all of us can really, you know, the moment you read it, it's a question that you've often thought of. What if everything I know to be real isn't?
Mm, exactly. What if the experience that I'm currently having is not even my experience.
Mm. And mine is perhaps an issue that I've struggled with on a more day-to-day basis. I grew up with a family that's vegetarian. So it's the cover thought experiment, the pig that wants to be eaten, which is in turn inspired by a vignette in Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker series.
Good evening, madame and gentlemen. I am the main dish of the day. May I interest you in parts of my body? Something off my shoulder, perhaps, braised in a little white wine sauce.
Your shoulder?
Well, naturally mine, sir. Nobody else's is mine to offer.
I think it's horrible. It's the most revolting thing I've ever heard.
Hey, what's the problem, Earthman?
I don't want to eat an animal that's lying there inviting me to. I think it's heartless.
It's better than eating an animal that doesn't want to be eaten.
It's the fifth thought experiment in the book. And essentially, it's this question of, if you can create an animal that is happy to be eaten, who is,
in fact, whose entire
life purpose,
yes,
is to be food for humans, then is it wrong to eat that animal? And it's a sort of simple premise to a larger question of, why do you choose to be vegetarian, for instance? Do you choose it because you fundamentally think it's cruel to animals? Do you choose it because you don't like the idea of taking a life to feed yourself? And what if by not eating that animal, you're actually causing it more harm, because then it feels like it hasn't fulfilled its purpose? So if you take away the aspect of the killing of a life, then is it something that makes sense? And for me, this was, I think it addressed a lot of my questions that I often ask people who are vegetarian or, you know, often being raised in a family where that's the status quo. A lot of people are that because that's what they're used to. And it's not because they think about it. It's not because it served a larger purpose. So I found that kind of, I think, interesting and also very relevant increasingly as we think about the choices we make in terms of what we choose to consume, how we live our lives, doing less harm, whether our actions that are meant to be good actually cause more harm. Yeah, so that for me was probably my favorite.
Just to add on to that, right, because the vignette that it comes from, Douglas Adams's, also includes Arthur Dent, the character in Hitchhiker's Guide, well, the human character anyway, basically turning down the cow in the story, mm-hmm. saying, well, no, that's horrendous.
Because
you're sentient.
The idea of it being a sentient creature, yeah.
Yeah, you're speaking. You're smart. I'm not going to eat you. Yeah. And instead opting for a salad, right? And then the cow in the story goes, well, okay, fine, but I know a lot of the vegetables don't want to be eaten. And so that adds like a whole other layer to it, which leads me ultimately to the central question here, which is that, thank you, Hanif, for recommending this book. However, you have entered a room with two people, I think, who generally read more fiction.
Yes.
And I'm curious as to whether or not that central question about the cow, whether that would have been as pressing to you or as interesting if you had read it in the context of Hitchhiker's Guide, if you had read it in the form of a fiction as opposed to in the form that Julien Bajigny presented it in, which is more of a, here's the thing and here's the explanation, here's the question.
Mm. I think I would probably be intrigued by it for a bit before moving on to the story. Yeah, right. To the rest of the story, yeah, I think. But generally, because I wouldn't probably think too much of it in that sense. But outside of, like, you know, in normal conversations, sometimes if I'm just doing something random, I will probably think about those things randomly. And also with friends, I guess. I think because you find the right friends, they can, like, sort of, like, provoke or invoke these kind of questions and make you ponder about these things.
It's all context then, I guess.
Yeah, I think so. I think it really is what catches your attention at that point in time. And what Julien Bajigny's book does is to distill those moments, whether from fiction or from philosophy, so that you can't ignore them or you can't move on. Mm. Well, all that remains to be done is to thank our special guest for our monthly book club this month. Thank you, Hanif, for joining us and for recommending that book.
Thank you very much for having me.
We've been talking today about Julien Bajigny's book, The Pig That Wants to Be Eaten, and 99 Other Thought Experiments, which is, yeah, a collection of what it says, thought experiments culled from philosophy, culled from pop culture, and presented to you.
Brings us to Footnotes, which is our weekly collection of bits and bobs about books. So because we were talking about Julien Bajigny's The Pig That Wants to Be Eaten, we thought it would be fun to talk about books in fiction, that is, that have sort of led us on a mind trip of sorts.
Sure, yes. books that challenge our ideas and concepts around reality. And we wanted to start, I think, with just a little tribute to the fact that the title of Julien Bajigny's book actually refers to a rather different animal, a cow, as we mentioned earlier with Hanif, right? And that takes place in Douglas Adams's A Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, a trilogy in 5 parts.
So specifically, this particular vignette comes in the Restaurant at the End of the Universe,
yes,
book. Yeah?
And so it doesn't strictly fall into this self-prescribed category, right, of things that mess with you. But anything that turns the Earth, spoiler alert, into nothing more than a giant computer run by mice, in order to try and generate the question, to which the answer is
42.
Correct. what is the meaning of life, the universe, and everything? Anything that does that turns us into mere occupants of a computer, I think, is worth mentioning.
Absolutely. So, Douglas Adams, thank you for changing our world as we knew it.
Thanks for all the fish. So we did also have other selections though. Sharmila, you want to start us off?
Yes. So this is an author that I have brought up before. In fact, we both have, which is Italo Calvino. But the book that I'm going to talk about is called If on a Winter's Night, a Traveller. And I actually only read this book fairly recently, even though I'm a pretty big fan of Calvino's works. You know, what a ride it is. It's really, the best way I can explain it is it's a book written like they're nesting dolls. You know, it refers to you. It starts off as you, and it goes, you, the reader, walk into a town, walk into a bookshop. And essentially, you go into a bookshop, you pick up a secondhand bookstore, you pick up a book, you start reading, and, you know, it has this, it's told in the first-person point of view, and you read a really gripping story, and then at some point, the rest of the book is just unreadable. So you go back to the bookstore, you get a replacement copy, and you start reading, and then the story is completely different. And this happens 10 different times in 10 different ways, and it's always from the first-person point of view. And along the way, you, quote-unquote, meet a fellow reader, and you're just never sure what's going on.
Honestly, listening to you, I feel unsettled. I haven't read the book, but yeah, just hearing it is making me feel oof.
It's fun in a certain way, in that way that Inception, you know, can be fun. But it is also anxiety-inducing.
Yeah.
And the best part of it is he trips around on different genres. So one of the stories feels like it's a spy thriller. Another one feels like, you know, like it's becoming a romance. Another one seems like a mystery. And you never quite know what it is. And at the end, it ends up being a sort of deconstruction of the novel itself, deconstruction of the act of reading and who is the storyteller versus who is the reader. It's brilliant. I would completely recommend it.
And the title of that again?
If on a Winter's Night, a Traveller.
So my selection is slightly, it's slightly different. It's called The Rorschach Texts, which is of course a reference to Rorschach, right?
Yeah.
Have you read this?
No, I have not. In fact, I was wondering whether you meant Rorschach as in the psychological test?
No.
Or sharks that are raw?
I mean, sharks as in Jaws and raw as in sushi. So
no, I have never even heard of this book.
Okay, so it is the debut novel by Stephen Hall, and it basically is... It's a trip. It's a combination of, if you've seen these films, it's a combination of The Matrix and meets Memento meets Jaws. I don't know.
What are you even saying?
Okay, all right. Let me try this out. So it involves an amnesiac who wakes up and is trying to piece together who he is because he's lost all sense of identity and is unsure. And then he has to kind of protect himself from something called a Ludovician shark, which is a steampunk-esque consciousness shark that feeds on your sense of identity and feeds on who you are as a person. So it plays with this idea of whether or not you are a person based on your body, or are you a person based on your consciousness? Are you a person based on your ideas, your memories? Is that who you are? And it takes place in this world where, yeah, so you have a protagonist who's trying to find out what has happened, who had a real life girlfriend who passed away. But I use the word real life very loosely, who has a girlfriend who has passed away and who then meets a mysterious young woman who has a tattoo in the same spot that his dead girlfriend did, but leads him through paths of consciousness on the search for a mysterious doctor who may be able to help them evade the sort of an insidious enemy by the name of Mycroft Ward, who is somebody who has managed to figure out how to imprint his consciousness onto people and is therefore nothing more than a virus, or nothing more than, you know, is he even a person? So it plays with all these ideas, and it is a pastiche of many different styles. I didn't pluck those examples out lightly. I mean, the Matrix examples are very clear. Mm-hmm. Memento also. Yes. And the last bit is really just a reconstruction of Jaws. The shark, while being a conceptual idea, is also a very real horror trope. I found it very scary to mm-hmm. read about, or to think about this idea that there is a shark who could be following me through my ideas, who could be tracking me through my search terms, my laptop, and will gobble up who I am as a person.
That concept is amazing and horrifying in equal measures.
And it's actually expressed in type. So the book actually plays with different forms of type in order to evoke that idea that a shark is after you. I mean, and I think I remember reading somewhere that the publication or the way that that had to be laid out was so complex that only one printer in Italy somewhere knew how to do it. But it's a really fun book. I don't know if I've made it sound fun.
I don't know whether fun would have been what came to mind, but I want to read it.
It is actually incredibly fun and thrilling, but it also prompted a lot of ideas. Like any good shark story, when I went swimming a week after reading it, I felt just a huge sense of anxiety. and yet, beyond all that, it's also a book about ideas. So I lost it in the back pocket of a seat of a bus. Mm-hmm. And I was halfway through and I went out and bought the book on the same day when I realized I'd left it behind. So it's that kind of book. You want to finish it. And yeah, it's called The Raw, as in sushi, Shark, as in Jaws, The Raw Shark Texts. It's by Stephen Hall. If you can find it, I enjoyed it a lot.
Well, do let us know what other books you might have in mind that have, I suppose, altered your sense of reality. So you can tweet us at BFM Radio. You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. This has been By the Book on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.